Hello and welcome to Hey, Remember the 80s? I'm Joe.
And I'm Carrie.
Remember, we're not professional podcasters or music critics. We're just left of center, off the strip, talking about 80s music.
Yeah.
Welcome, Carrie.
Thanks, Joe. Welcome to you.
And welcome to any new listeners and loyal listeners. We found some out in New Iberia, Louisiana, Encinitas, California, and Budapest, Hungary.
Hello to all those folks.
Hello.
Hello to everyone else. Keep up with us on Facebook at facebook.com/HRT80S and find us on Blue Sky.
Yes, please.
So we have some tidbits.
Oh, yeah. Plenty.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so I teased this last week. There was an article in Vulture about Pino Palladino. If you don't know that name, he is a Welsh bassist who is very famous. He's always been sort of a session musician. I mean, he's been part of different bands at different times. He just has a huge legacy. And this Vulture article starts off by talking about how there is a incomplete Spotify playlist of about 946 songs that Pino Palladino played on. And a fun game is to open the playlist, think of a random number, and see which songs he has played on. So, Joe, I want you to give me two numbers between 1 and 946.
Let's see. How about number 101?
Okay, number 101 is A Moment in Shrine by Rian Benson. I don't know who that is.
I thought you were going to say A Moment in Time. That would have been better.
Yeah, no. You picked a bad number.
Sorry. Okay, let's go for one that's not obvious. 391.
391. That is Sweat It Out by Elton John from his album The One.
Nice.
Yeah. So some other ones. I'm just scrolling through this very quickly. Some other ones on here. Chaka Khan, Dave Koz. The person who wrote this article did it much better. They said 242 is Come to My Window by Melissa Etheridge, and 163 is Do You Remember by Phil Collins. This list is just nuts. Kirsty MacColl, he's been playing a lot with John Mayer in recent years. Let's talk about one of the songs mentioned in this article, Sunset Grill by Don Henley. And it has a very interesting story. Pino says he played bass on a song by Nick Hayward called Whistle Down the Wind. Let's hear a clip of that. Hello, hello, hope you're feeling fine. Hello, hello, hope you're feeling mine. He says that there was a little bass solo, and it was rare for pop songs to have that. Apparently, Danny Kortchmar, who was Don Henley's producer, heard that and said, "Who is this?" They found out it was a guy named Pino Palladino. They got his number and called him and said, "Hey, this is Don Henley. I want you to come play on a song for me." Pino Palladino thought it was a joke. And he says he was on tour with Paul Young in New York City, and he didn't even know when he was going to get to do a session for Don. And he sent his gear home to London, then got the call, "Hey, can you come to LA tomorrow to record?" Pino said, "Sure, sure, sure." And then he had to go run to a music store and buy a new bass to take with him. And he says, "Sunset Grill left a lot of space for the bass. We used different bits from different performances and put them all on one track. I feel that song, once it was finished and people heard it, led to me working in America a bit more. It was quite rare for British musicians to cross over the water." Hard to get home with any pride.
There is no hiding place.
So very, very interesting story about Pino Palladino. You can check out that whole article in Vulture and then check out that playlist with all those amazing songs.
We should put that link up because it really is. He really just, I read the article and I just have seen his name, I don't know, a million times in the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. I know you said he worked with John Mayer. He was all over that Sob Rock album.
Yes.
That we talked about a few years ago that was 80s influenced. And he really went and got the 80s players. I love that.
Yeah. He doesn't fit into one category. Like, he just plays with everyone. The most recent song they talk about in this article is Watermelon Sugar by Harry Styles. So, I mean, this guy is just the go-to guy.
Mm-hmm.
You need a bassist? Get Pino Palladino.
Love that name, too.
And then, Joe, I have some extreme breaking news. On the day we are recording this, so I was reading this Pino Palladino article. I Googled Don Henley because I wanted to go look at the rest of the credits for Sunset Grill. And all of these articles came up as being published like 1 hour ago about Don Henley. And I was like, what's this about? Have you heard about the Hotel California trial, Joe?
I feel like I saw a headline and then I saw your link, breaking news.
Yes.
And I read this article about the outcome. I think I read it 3 times. And then I said to myself, Joe, don't hurt your pretty little head about this. Carrie's a lawyer. She is going to break it on down.
I've been meaning to talk about this in Tidbits. It's a good candidate for Tidbits, but it's more 70s focused. But I thought there was some interesting stuff going on. I was kind of following it. So let me try to give you the nutshell. So there is apparently this huge controversy over handwritten lyrics to Hotel California and other Eagles hits. Don Henley apparently claims they were stolen from him many years ago, and he came to find out who had them. I guess it was 3 different men. They were collectors and, you know, were in the business of memorabilia. So they were trying to sell these lyrics, and Don Henley found out and was like, no, 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 those are stolen. Those are stolen. These gentlemen maintained, no, they procured them through proper channels. Don Henley was saying, no, you know they're stolen, blah, blah, blah. This sounds like it should be a civil matter. Civil means two common folk going after each other in court. Well, Don Henley somehow convinced the Manhattan District Attorney's Office to charge these men criminally. On the one hand, yes, someone's claiming something was stolen. But on the other hand, why do we care about this? You know what I mean? Like, it's not a murder. Somebody didn't get taken advantage of and have their fortune stolen. This is Don Henley's claiming, you know, someone stole some pieces of paper from him. It's kind of strange. Prosecutors would get involved in this. Well, today, what came out, Don Henley and his personal attorneys who had been, you know, pursuing claims around this case and had been involved from the beginning, had been withholding a lot of information from the prosecutors. And once they disclosed that, the prosecutors realized they had been bamboozled by Don Henley. And the facts of the case were not what Don Henley had represented to them all along. And they just up and dismissed the charges in the middle of the criminal trial, said, we're not going forward with this anymore. We don't think a crime has been committed. We don't think we can prove a crime has been committed. We're done with this. And made some pretty wild accusations about Don Henley in the press. Don Henley and his lawyers are saying, oh, we didn't do anything wrong. And now they're saying they're going to pursue this civilly. So this will continue, but not in criminal court. That's the best I can give you. Did that make sense, Joe?
Well, it did. But you're leaving out some key things I saw, which was Don Henley didn't want to tell anyone but his personal lawyers. He had given the written lyrics to someone who was going to write a book about the Eagles and he forgot about it.
Yeah, I mean, that was part of what he said. He had claimed, I think, all along that he had given them away to someone for some purpose, but he expected to get them back. And then at some point, they fell into the hands of these gentlemen, and Don Henley was saying, oh, that wasn't what I wanted to happen with them, etc. beyond just the fact that this is a strange case for a prosecutor to get involved with, nothing seemed very clear. It wasn't like a slam dunk case, which, again, you know, if you're a prosecutor, you don't really take flyers on cases most of the time. You pretty much only charge people that you feel like you have a good chance of convicting. And this seemed like a very weird case in terms of the chain of custody and not an easy case to prove.
And one of the defendants was a former Rock and Roll Hall of Fame curator. That's crazy. And then I also saw that once they were like exonerated, they had tearful hugs with their family members. And I thought, geez, how serious was this, right? Like, were they going to get the chair?
Well, I mean, a criminal trial, they were going to get a huge fine and jail time. Again, this is so bizarre. It's like, why?
Why did any of this,
happen? Yeah. I hadn't really been following it very closely. I knew Don Henley was going to testify, but one of the other headlines linked in here says Eagles' Don Henley quizzed at Lyric's trial about time a naked 16-year-old girl overdosed at his home. And that's another wild thing about this. Like, why would Don Henley want to subject himself to this?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, of course, if you get called to testify in a case, you know, your credibility is fair game. So if, yeah, you had an issue like this in the past, it's going to get brought up.
Why does Don Henley want to keep this going? You know what I mean? After all this?
Yeah.
I guess it's true. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave.
Exactly. These guys are regretting the day they even heard Hotel California.
Ay, ay, ay.
I thought that was really wild, and I will be interested to find out what happens with this going forward. Oh, but also, gosh. You know what, Don Henley? Freaking go away. I mean, just stop. Just stop. I think that's it for tidbits, unless there's something else you want to throw in the mix, Joe.
No tidbits, Carrie. We're going to move on to the first topic. I say first topic because guess what? I looked ahead. I know there's a quiz coming. Okay. I'm not going to feign surprise like I normally do. I've been preparing to have a raw egg in the morning, jog up some stairs.
You do some pull-ups.
Never done a pull-up in my life. First topic today, Carrie, we're going to talk about obscure soundtrack songs. We have talked about obscure soundtrack songs many times before. And we put out a call on Facebook for the listeners to suggest some for this next go-round. And we got so many great recommendations, so we want to say thank you to everyone that contributed. And if we don't get to yours this time, we have made a list of the others to cover in the future. We're going to start with a song that Carrie came across recently and has always wanted to know more about. It's a song called Storybook Love from The Princess Bride. Rob Reiner was a fan of Dire Straits and Mark Knopfler and specifically asked Knopfler to score the film. Reiner believed he could create a soundtrack that would be quirky yet romantic. Knopfler said he would do it on one condition, that Reiner include a baseball cap that Reiner had worn in This Is Spinal Tap in The Princess Bride. That seems crazy to me.
Have you ever seen This Is Spinal Tap?
I haven't seen This Is Spinal Tap, and I haven't seen The Princess Bride.
Oh, so my gosh.
I know. I'm ready for my flogging.
Well, I think I watched This Is Spinal Tap one time. I think it's funny that people are so obsessed with it to the extent that they would do something like this. Say, I want that cap in there.
Well, I mean, if there's any group of people who would be that obsessed with that movie, I guess it could be Mark Knopfler and other rockers of that time, right?
That's true. I guess that makes sense.
They knew that world. So Reiner actually did it, putting a similar cap in the grandson's room, but Knopfler later claimed he was only joking. Yeah, right, sis. Storybook Love was the only song with lyrics included on the album, and it wasn't written by Knopfler. It was written by the gent who sung it, Willie DeVille. Here's a clip.
And how he worshipped the ground she walked, and when he looked in her eyes, he became obsessed. My love is like a storybook story, but it's as real as the feelings I feel. My love is like a storybook story, but it's as real as the feelings I feel.
DeVille had fronted the punk band Mink DeVille, but was a solo artist at this time. Knopfler was producing his solo album, and that's how Storybook Love ended up in the movie. It was nominated for Best Song at the Oscars, and DeVille performed it at the ceremony, but the song lost to The Time of My Life from Dirty Dancing. I just remembered another tidbit I wanted to bring up. Okay. Did you read the Stereogum article, Tom Brienne, ranking Diane Warren's Oscar-nominated
no.
songs?
But I feel like I read one last year. Was it updated?
I don't remember one before. He did say in the beginning that since now there are 15 of them, he felt like it was a good number to do this list.
Okay.
Made me think it was the first time, but who knows?
Yeah, no, I didn't. But thank you, because I definitely want to
read it. Now. We'll talk about it next week. Yeah, it's pretty good.
Okay, so we already know that you haven't seen The Princess Bride. That is kind of wild to me. I think it's kind of one of those movies that I feel like everyone is forced to see at one time or another, but maybe that was a girl thing.
I don't think so. I feel like in my life, I've had just as many men say to me as women, "You've never seen The Princess Bride? Go to hell."
I definitely am not one of those people that's obsessed with The Princess Bride or reveres it, but I do enjoy it very much. I think I only saw it once when I was a kid. I think it's a movie that you oftentimes, when you run into people that, you know of it, say, "Oh yeah, we watched it all the time." Like, it's one of those ones that people watched over and over. That was not my situation. You know, I catch it on TV every once in a while, and it's kind of one of those movies that I always end up watching when it's on TV. This song is so beautiful. I think it's really interesting that Mark Knopfler wrote the whole score, but then didn't write this song. You know, I mean, he arranged it and produced it. He was very much involved in it.
Yeah.
Do you know Mink DeVille, that band?
I've seen the name, I think, in the Charlie's Library. Do they have a song called, like, Story of Love? No, that's the song. What is the song I know by then?
I don't try to think of it now. It's something like Each Word's a Beat of My Heart.
Is that the one I'm thinking of? That might be.
I think so. I think that's the only one we have in the attic. But this guy, Willie DeVille, has a really unique voice. And that's the other thing about this song that's kind of bizarre, is that it's very, like, sweet and lovely, but his voice is not. So I've talked a lot about it. What do you think of the song, Joe?
Knowing what you know about me not seeing this movie, I find it funny that my first thought is, I just feel like the song really fits the mood and the look of what I know of the movie. I've seen bits and pieces, you know, it's not like I have no context at all, but I feel like it fits. I really enjoyed it.
It fits with the movie very, very well. And it does evoke the movie. It's funny to hear it and then kind of feel yourself put into that world. Yeah, it made me want to watch Princess Bride again. Good job, I guess. Up next, a suggestion from Bill G, Left of Center by Suzanne Vega from the Pretty in Pink soundtrack. And that one is one of my personal faves. We talked about it all the way back in episode 11, but there's a lot to say about Left of Center. Suzanne Vega attended the High School of Performing Arts in New York City, you know, the Fame High School, and she started performing in folk cafes while she was attending college. There was a regular songwriters group at the Cornelia Street Cafe that she was a part of.
Cornelia Street.
I know, I included that because I knew you'd get a kick out of it. Well, that group put out anthology albums called Fast Folk. And Suzanne was one of the first of those artists to sign a major label deal. Her debut album had some success on the album chart in 1985. And the next year, she co-wrote Left of Center specifically for the movie with her producer, Steve Adaabo. And if you want me, you can find me left of center, wondering about you. Joe Jackson is playing piano on the track. This one did not chart in the US, but it made it to 32 on the UK chart. And Suzanne would break out the next year with her single Luca. And she's touring this spring.
That would be a good show, I feel like.
Yeah, I think it would be. She seems like she would put on a good show.
I feel like the comment I just made is showing my cards about how I feel about this song. It's so good. I love it. Now, Carrie, I'm sorry. I didn't have the Pretty in Pink soundtrack back in the day. I only learned this song, I would say, in the last 5 years.
Mm.
And every time it comes on, I'm always like, oh, yes, this is the mm-hmm. song. I love it. It's so moody. And then it kind of picks up within like 30 seconds. I'm like, oh, my God, it's a banger. I love it.
It really does set the tone for the movie. I mean, obviously, the kind of centerpiece of the movie and what plays over the opening credits is the song Pretty in Pink. But this song really tells the story of the movie. There's so much happening. Like, it keeps kind of changing up tempos and different instruments, you know, come in, like the piano at different times. And it's a great, 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 great song. And when you pair it with the movie, it just becomes this kind of indelible mm-hmm. item that will forever be burned into my brain.
And let's just say it, it's better than Luca.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I have really bad associations with Luca. You know, I was a kid. I thought it was just a silly little song about a kid that lives upstairs or whatever. And then you learned
from Casey Kasem, right?
About yeah. a kid mm-hmm. getting abused. And I think we've talked about this before. First time that you realize as a kid something like that can happen, and you're like, what? It's hard to hear.
And I think we brought this up before. Her husband was Mitchell Froom.
Correct. Not until the 90s. Yeah.
Yeah. A few years in the 90s.
Exactly. Mitchell Froom. Everyone knows that name. He is a member of Crowded House.
Well, David N. thought we should talk about a song called Tonight Is What It Means to Be Young by Fire Inc. Should I say Fire Inc. or Fire Incorporated?
I don't know.
Fire LLC. This one's from the movie Streets of Fire. Another great suggestion. Director Walter Hill had just had huge success with a movie that he also wrote, 48 Hours. Paramount was willing to let him make basically any movie he wanted, and the result was Streets of Fire, a movie that Hill said included all the things he thought made a perfect film when he was a teenager, including custom cars, kissing in the rain, rock stars, and leather jackets. Ugh, so now we gotta watch this movie because he, like, never grew up.
Yeah.
We won't get too much into the story of the movie. It's basically a 50s movie about gangs with 80s-style music. Diane Lane plays a singer named Ellen Aim. Jimmy Iovine produced the soundtrack album, and he used two different female singers' voices to dub Diane's singing voice in the movie. Lori Sargent of the band Face to Face, and Holly Sherwood, a session vocalist who often worked with Jim Steinman. The song, Tonight Is What It Means to Be Young, was written by Steinman. No. Holly is singing lead on this song, but she's backed by the other members of Face to Face and what sounds to me also like 1,000 other people.
Yes.
Sargent would sing lead on a different song from the movie called Nowhere Fast, but these songs were all credited to Fire Incorporated, Fire Inc. And this song closes out the movie. Steinman says it was written in 2 days. Because the filmmakers had assumed they could and would use the song Streets of Fire by Bruce Springsteen for the closing sequence. When that fell through, they had to ask Steinman to come up with something and then rebuild the sets to reshoot that sequence. Iovine made Steinman the scapegoat for the money it cost for all that, telling the movie studio that Steinman had been asked to write the closing song and had taken 8 months to do it. That is real shade.
I know. Real awful. But I guess Jim Steinman could get away with something like that. I think he was pretty successful. I've read about this soundtrack so many different times, and I still don't understand this reference. They always talk about how Iovine used these two different ladies' voices. And I've always thought to myself, do they mean that sometimes it was one? Or yeah, or did it combine them? I still didn't get clarity on that, although I did, you know, see that Holly was singing lead on this song. Have you ever seen Streets of Fire?
No, we talked about renting it when you come to visit. Yeah, we got to put this to bed and know what exactly it is.
I know.
My friend Siobhan says she loved this movie and she loves this song.
Yeah.
I was like, I can't believe you even know this song.
I really like this song too. That's why I want to see it. I have wanted to see it for a long time and have never gotten around to it. Listen, if you heard the song and someone was like, who wrote this song? You would say Jim Steinman.
Oh, yeah. Dave today, he was like, what is this song? I'm like, if you've never heard it, you at least know the songwriter. He's like, Diane Warren? And I'm like, no, think of the one songwriter we say must have gotten paid by the word. Oh, Jim Steinman. It really does kind of have the Bonnie Tyler feel.
Absolutely.
The Air Supply, Making Love Out of Nothing at All, just kind of this, not talk singing, that's not fair, but just a conversational style of songwriting.
Yeah. And way over the top.
Unedited, yes. Yeah, unfiltered, yes.
Yeah, he like told Holly, open it up and take it for a ride.
Vroom, vroom. I've never seen the movie, but I can just picture like groups and gangs and squaring off on the streets, a fire. And you know what I mean? Like you can, it really does build that world with the music and the lyrics.
I mean, the whole point of a soundtrack song is that it's supposed to be a part of the movie's story, right? And again, if you just heard the song in a void and someone said, okay, this is from a movie, what do you think this movie
what
is about?
What movie's about? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, you would probably come up with Kissing in the Rain or Rock Stars in Leather Jackets.
Leather Jackets.
He got it. He got whatever Walter Hill was trying to put down.
Yeah. I don't want to put you on the spot, but Face to Face, what do they sing?
I think their top 40 hit was 10-9-8.
Okay, then what does Eye to Eye sing?
Maybe I'm confusing.
Because there's a face
them.
To face.
You're right.
There's an eye to eye. Sure, there's a nose to nose somewhere, right? Who sang Lucky and Nice Girls?
That's one of them.
This is too much. Yeah. We might have to do a episode just about those two groups.
It does get very confusing. And I'm trying to look them up. They don't even have a Wikipedia page.
Yeah, it's real hard, real tough.
Hold on. Now I got to find this out. Okay, so Face to Face was a quintet from Boston. And their big song was 10-9-8.
10-9-8.
Yes.
I'm always da-da. Anana back to one.
Yes. And I think Eye to Eye, if I'm remembering correctly, is the weird band that was a man and a woman. The woman was from California and the man was from England. Yes.
And what did they sing?
They sang Nice Girls and Lucky.
And that one of those songs goes, oh, oh, oh. No, I'm not doing it right. Nice Girls, oh, oh. You know what I'm trying to say.
I really don't, but I mean...
Maybe that's Lucky. Okay, sorry. This is a tangent. That's gone too far.
Yeah, we've gone down the rabbit hole here. But let's get back to the soundtrack songs. Kendra K had so many great suggestions, and we're going to talk about one of them now. Lost in the Shadows by Lou Gramm from The Lost Boys. The Lost Boys was one of those movies that I watched about 500 times in the several years after it was released in the summer of 1987. I even had the soundtrack on cassette.
Oh.
There are a number of iconic songs from the movie, including this one by Lou. He had left Foreigner and released his first solo album earlier in the year. Lost in the Shadows soundtracks the scene when Jason Patrick's character is riding around on motorcycles with the vampire gang for the first time. And there was a video made for the song, which included clips from the movie, edited with scenes of Lou Gramm wandering around a wooden cage, being accosted by presumably vampiric women. I don't know. The video is really dumb.
You know, I had low expectations going into it. And before I even clicked on the link, I thought, Lou Gramm in a song for a movie about teen vampires. Yeah. Like, I just feel like he's a little square for that. But They really made him look good. I mean, you know, he had the big fluffy 80s permed hair, but the leather jacket, he really looked rough. And I felt like the song fit that too. Am I crazy?
You're not crazy. And I'm watching it again here on mute while we're talking. And part of the key was he's always being shot in like half shadow. He is yeah, literally
it's very,
lost.
It's a very dark video. Yeah. But it's got vampires in it. They can't have full sun, Carrie.
I know. It's just so bizarre, whatever is going on with him. But yeah, I think it's a great song, and it really fits the mood of the movie.
I know what you're going to ask. This is another one I watched a zillion times as a kid. We must have had it on tape somehow. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I couldn't tell you. I mean, spoiler alert, I kind of have a memory that Grandpa Gilmore is dating Diane Wiest.
Yes.
And you don't think he's like the main vampire, but he is. And then they kill him.
Yes.
Oh my God.
I feel
like that's crazy.
This is one of those movies that I saw so many times that it's not something that like immediately springs to my mind as like a movie I know a lot about.
A formative movie from your childhood.
But literally, I could tell you right now, I could talk about every scene. I could describe everything that happens from start to finish. It's crazy. I was really tickled to see this suggestion and was really happy to think about The Lost Boys again.
Well, let's keep that feeling going because we're going to take a moment to talk about some of the other classic songs from The Lost Boys. We did talk about Good Times by NXS and Jimmy Burns back in episode 152. But the theme from The Lost Boys is a song called Cry Little Sister by Gerard McMahon. He was a session musician that had found a niche writing and performing songs for movies. He had a song called The Look in Your Eyes included on the Fast Times at Ridgemont High soundtrack. And he had three different songs used in Hard Bodies. We're just going to be talking about Hard Bodies until we're old and gray.
I mean, you know, it is really funny. Every time that it comes up, I'm like, haven't we already talked about every song that was in that movie? But I guess not.
Next week, we'll talk about the score. Well, McMahon wrote this song without seeing a single frame of the film, and director Joel Schumacher was shocked that he nailed the tone of the movie so well. That scream I hear, cry, little sister. McMahon says the song is not really about vampires, but rather the longing for a family from a rejected youth's perspective. An instrumental version is played hauntingly over the opening credits, and then returns with lyrics a couple more times during the movie. 20 different children sang the choir part individually, and then McMahon arranged them together to get the strange effect that he intended. What'd you think of that part?
I mean, insanely creepy.
The whole thing is creepy.
Well, that's true.
The record label didn't want to release the song as a single because they said it was too futuristic sounding. According to McMahon, the label even had Phil Collins and Steve Perry record versions, but Joel Schumacher demanded that McMahon's version be included in the film. I want to see those receipts.
I know, that is so wild. I like Googled. I was hoping maybe there was a demo version out on YouTube of Phil Collins.
Did Phil Collins talk about it in his book?
No, at absolutely all? Not.
Yeah, I don't believe it. Yeah. Is what I'm going to say about it.
I mean, maybe like they were trying to
talked
get
about
them.
It. Yeah.
No. Anyways, yeah, this song is definitely imprinted on my brain as well. It is insanely creepy.
So creepy.
I talked about being a scaredy cat. I don't know that I was really scared by The Lost Boys, which doesn't
that
make much sense.
Me.
I know.
How did that, yeah, you were scared of like Howard the Duck.
But this song did scare me. I think I remember not listening to it very often on the cassette, like skipping over it because it really creeped me out. And it is very effective, very, very effective. So yeah, this guy did a great job.
Agreed. Yeah.
I forget, and I didn't put it in here, but he now goes by a different name and is a DJ or something. It's kind of like, okay, guy, it's time to take it down a notch.
I bet he's a vampire now. the vampires found him. They're like, this song's too creepy. You're one of us. Vampires talk like robots, didn't you know?
Well, we can't talk about The Lost Boys without discussing the most infamous scene from the movie, which features Tim Capello's insane sax playing on I Still Believe. First things first, this song had been recorded by The Call the year before, and it hit number 17 on the rock chart. Tim Capello had been a touring saxophonist in the 70s for acts like Peter Gabriel and Eric Carmen. He developed a heroin habit, and after he went cold turkey, he started bodybuilding. He became known for his very muscular physique and often performed scantily clad and oiled up. He was primarily performing with Tina Turner at the time he was featured in The Lost Boys. Through the tears, through the crowds. Joel Schumacher had wanted The Call to perform the song in the movie, but Michael Biehn, the songwriter and lead singer of that band, refused because he thought the subject matter of the movie was not a good fit for their Christian band. And that is really Tim singing on the track as well. He credits his appearance in this movie for his continued relevance in pop culture. John Hamm performed as Sergio, the crazy sexy sax man, in an SNL digital short that was very obviously based on Tim. And Tim himself appeared in the first season finale of Reservation Dogs, reprising his performance of I Still Believe.
Does he still look good?
He does. He does still look good. Yeah.
That clip from The Lost Boys was insane. I know. Insane. He was so buff and so oily.
I know.
And the whole scene is just the audience, like Jason Patrick noticing Jamie Gertz and Jamie Gertz noticing him and the kids looking around the crowd. I'm like, there's no way people are not looking at him on stage. You know what I mean? I'm like, the vampires, I believe, but this part is not plausible at all.
100%. And he's really giving it. Like, he's dancing.
Yes.
He's gyrating. He's doing something with the mic. You know, yeah, it's a lot.
The fire. Yes. God, that was sweat. It wasn't oil. He was sweaty from that fire right in his face.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you know what? I do like this song. I think this is a good song. Yeah. I think it's very good.
I love this song. I will say that I'm a little perplexed by the choice to have him sing on it as well.
Yeah. Where did they go from The Call's not going to do it and then his name gets thrown into the ring, right? Like, I think we missed a step.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, he obviously has the chops to do the horn part and sounds great. But yeah, I'm not sure why they were just like, let's just have him sing it too.
You know who's perfect for this? Tim. Well, there's one last obscure soundtrack song to cover this week, and it was suggested by Chris M. It's from the movie Real Genius, and the song is called I'm Falling, performed by the Comset Angels. Carrie, it sounds like you're pretty familiar with this one because Real Genius is your husband Nick's favorite movie.
Indeed, indeed.
So when was the last time it played in your house?
That's a good question. I don't know for sure because it's permanently on our DVR and I don't know the last time that Nick watched it. I haven't watched it with him for a couple of years at least. He gets up to stuff when I'm not paying attention.
Right. The band was formed in the late 70s in England, and they took their name from a short story named The Comset Angels by J.G. Ballard. He's probably best known for writing the novel Empire of the Sun, which Steven Spielberg turned into a movie. But all right, back to the band. The song was originally recorded for their fifth studio album, and producer James M. Toomey has a co-writing credit.
I was
The entire song is featured in the movie over a montage and reached number 90 in the UK. In the credits to the movie, they're credited as the CS Angels because a U.S. communications company held a trademark on the word Comset and threatened legal action if the band performed music in the U.S. as the Comset Angels. So when did that company come about? Because couldn't J.G. Ballard sue them? I'm being serious. You're a lawyer.
Well, they trademarked it in the U.S. at some point.
Okay. They did their homework then. All right. Case dismissed. Did you watch the video?
I did watch the video.
But I was going to talk about the end where they had the kids kind of like morph their faces into each other. Oh. And I was like, Bentley and Cream, you ain't.
I didn't get that far, I guess.
Oh, yeah. You got to watch it.
Okay.
Just go watch that part later. That sounds insane.
I don't like it. Yeah. But yeah, this song is another one where I always forget about it. And then as soon as it starts playing, I'm like, what's this song? And then when it kicks in and I recognize it, I'm like, oh yeah, it's that great song from Real Genius.
I started out not wanting to like it. But as it went on, I was like, this is really something. Mm-hmm. This is really a song that deserves to be heard still.
Yeah.
And it's just not. I don't know. The song moved me. I liked it a lot.
Yeah. I was really tickled to learn that James M. Toomey was the producer and co-wrote this with them. I'm like, wow, I'd never heard that before. And I think it says something about why this song works so well, because there's something a little bit different about it. Not just straight new wave or what have you. There's a little bit of a twinge in there.
I did also watch the clip from the movie that's a montage, which I don't know. I feel like a 3.5 minute montage where there's no talking, I feel like that's a little bit lazy to me. You know what I mean? How long is this movie? 88 minutes? But I'm glad I watched it because I haven't seen this movie since the 80s. I remembered everything. They show that clip of him in the classroom and a few people have tape recorders. And I'm like, oh, by the end, everyone's going to be recording and the teacher's going to have a tape recorder playing.
That's funny. I don't think I ever saw Real Genius back in the day.
I don't know how I did or why, but I did. I haven't seen it since the 80s, guaranteed.
Yeah. Whenever I did see it, the thing that made an impression on me the most was that...
The popcorn.
No, that's one thing. But that guy lived in the closet or whatever, that he would always emerge from the closet. And that was really freaky to me. And isn't that the guy that was in White Lotus?
Yeah, and Napoleon Dynamite.
Yes, yes, yes.
That's yeah, right. And I only know that because, I mean, I looked it up after I watched this clip because I'm like, did he think that guy was a vampire and that's why he's using the mirror to make sure his reflection is there? And that's when I saw who it was. I was like, whoa, that was him?
Very strange. He looks the same age. What's his name? True. John Greers? I don't know how to say his last name. Yeah. He literally looks the same in Real Genius and Whenever I Last Saw Him, which was in the first season of White Lotus.
We talked about a movie that had a long wiki entry for the plot. Real Genius is longer. It was like, I was like, I don't have time for this. It's a laser. Okay, move on.
Very much so. All right, well, that wraps up our main segment, and Joe's already spoiled it. Our next one is a quiz.
The producer just gave me a note. He said we ran long and we have to postpone this quiz.
No, we
for
can
2 years.
We can do it because this is only one day, 6 questions. So we're going to get in and out of it very quickly.
Do not tell me how many you got right.
I will not. I will not tell you how many I got right. I will just launch into question number one, which is, what comedian received a lifetime ban from MTV after a controversial routine at the 1989 Video Music Awards?
It's got to be Andrew Dice Clay.
That is correct. And I just realized I haven't even introduced this, but you know what? If this is your first time listening to the podcast, sometimes we do quizzes. There you go.
Yeah.
All right, Joe, this next one is the first audio clip that we've had in this entire series.
Really?
Yes. But let me read the question to you first. This is the introduction to a 1964 soul single, which was famously covered in 1981 by a British band whose version became one of the biggest hits of the 80s. Name the song.
Oh, Oh my gosh. So I have to name this song?
Mm-hmm.
Is it Boy from New York City?
Joe.
What?
Became one of the biggest hits of the 80s.
I know. I thought it was their biggest hit, though. My other guess was Good Thing.
Listen to it one more time.
Well, you're not going to give me the point if I get it, but I will listen to it one more time. Oh my God. Yes, I got it now.
What is it?
I'm going to guess, but you're not going to give it to me. But let me just get this for my sanity. Taint and Love.
Yes. I will give it to you because I had to listen to it about six different times. And I can tell you that I didn't get it. I kept saying, oh my gosh, I can hear it. I hear it. But I couldn't translate it into what it was. So I will give you that point because it was very difficult.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
So you are 2 for 2. And question 3 is, this is a still frame from what video?
Journey, Separate Ways.
Correct.
That one on the front looks like my dad. I'm not even kidding.
He does, Bezo. I've seen your dad. Okay, question 4. Name the horrific group, which was the most successful pop act from Sweden in the late 80s.
Why are they horrific?
I don't know.
Say it one more time.
Name the horrific group, which was the most successful pop act from Sweden in the late 80s.
I mean, I'd have to say Roxette.
That's correct.
But why are they horrific?
I don't know. I was very flummoxed by that as well. And I was like, but it has to be Roxette, but I don't understand that.
Yeah.
Lisa Coleman, Dr. Fink, Bobby Z, Wendy Melvoin, and Brown Mark were better known as what band?
The Revolution.
Mm-hmm. All right, last question for today. Who often referred to himself as Triple J?
The MTV VJ? JJ?
Okay. Do you know his last name?
Shh. Just give me a second. Okay. I'm going to guess, because it's just not coming to me, which let's just say how many times we've read the book VJ, and I want my MTV. So this is just nerves, right?
Mm-hmm.
Jackson?
That is correct. JJ Jackson. I think it
I don't
is
know
hard
what
because
is wrong with
I
me.
Just always thought of him as JJ. Like, I don't even honestly remember him saying his last name a lot. It was always just, just JJ.
And Triple J.
So you got 6 out of 6, Joe. I got 5 out of 6. So
okay,
you have
so
gained
where are we at?
1 point from me. I am currently at 43 and you have 40.
Okay.
That's it. That was a long one. Lots of good stuff to talk about, though.
Yeah, and like we said, more soundtrack stuff to come. Hopefully, you know, I mentioned it earlier, but maybe we could throw some Howard the Duck in there.
I don't know.
I have it on vinyl.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
That's another one I haven't seen, and I need to see. You know, I've saw it so many years ago. Next week, Joe, we are going to have a segment we are calling You Don't Have to Yell. So you're going to have to tune in to find out what that's all about.
That's a tease.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else, Joe?
Nope. That will cover it.
Well, then I'll take us out. I'll say, hey, be kind to yourself, most importantly. Enjoy every sandwich. And demand that others are good to you by getting right in their face with your backup saxophonist blowing in their ear and scream.
I wonder how close those two were.
Better be good to me.
Yes. Thanks for listening.
Bye.